Okay, thanks to the organizers for giving me a chance to speak. I hope it's not a little bit too unorganized. So let me start by, especially in light of Esteban Rene's talk, we've also done some simulations of cosmic ray propagation of the galaxy. And that actually provides some insight into a number of issues, both propagation, the nature of gamma ray bursts in the galaxy, and the frequency of these events. So what we have here is a gamma ray burst with a radial jet with about a 0.1 steradian opening angle. So it's a 5-6 degree half angle opening jet. Now these are color coded by energy. So the darkest is between the, it's a little hard to see here, but above 10 to the 19th to 10 to the 20th eV are the highest energy particles. As you go down in decade, you go down to at least the lowest is 10 to the 16th eV. And they're half divided into protons and neutrons. So the neutrons just traverse, so if this hypothetical gamma ray burst went off at 3 kiloparsecs, the neutrons would go out practically coincident with a photonic wave on both sides of the jet. And you can see where they haven't decayed. Once they decay, then you start getting this large cloud of the neutron decay protons, as well as the high energy protons. In the middle, what you have is actually a little cloud, because at these energies, now at 10 to the 16th to 10 to the 17th eV, the protons are stuck essentially in a molasses. There's the magnetic fields, and the propagation characteristics depend on at least two things. So the spectrum of turbulence, because here, we assume that they follow large-scale field lines, just a ray tracing through the Lorentz force, and these lines represent the peaks of the magnetic field distribution, but also they diffuse through pitch angle scattering. They're randomized. So as a consequence, you get this sort of characteristic scattering spectrum there. And here, the simulation goes for about 10,000 years, so something's artificial already. Once you go to about 10,000 years, there's a good chance there's a second gamma ray burst that will have gone off in the galaxy. So over somewhere else, there would have been another gamma ray burst. About once every 10,000 to 100,000 years, a gamma ray burst goes off in the galaxy, according to the statistics I've looked at. And so we could find ourselves in a cloud of high-energy particles, though very unlikely in the highest-energy particle cloud, because those just pass through very quickly, they're gone. But these that diffuse rather more slowly, they go out quasi-spherically symmetric, we can find ourselves in that cosmic ray cloud. Now, here we have pitch angle scattering as well as ray tracing. If you turn off ray tracing, lots of funny things happen. So this is a transverse jet. So this is where it's just ray traced, and they follow this bisymmetric field structure according to this model of Alvarez Muniz, and Todorstanov is part of that. And you get completely different sort of behaviors. So the inclusion of pitch angle scattering in the propagation makes a big difference, and actually it starts to approach in these medium energies just a characteristic diffusion calculation that you could do analytically. At the highest energies, there's between about 10 to the 16th and 10 to the 18th, there's a combination of pitch angle scattering as well as following the magnetic field lines. At higher energies, they pretty much go straight out of the galaxy. But as was discussed yesterday, there's a lot of physics buried beneath these calculations. And how do you get to that physics? Well, I think that we get to that physics by looking at the data. And so now let me go to the content of my talk here.
Can I ask a question before you go back
now? Sure.
Is the blue ones that go out at the end of the jets are all neutrons?
Yeah, those are essentially all neutrons, or the highest energy protons.
The blue ones that are scattered behind are the decaying protons from neutron decay?
These are essentially, as they decay, then they start deflecting. So you see this wave of particles, which are the neutron decay protons.
Okay.
But there's also some very high energy protons that follow on because they're not deflected by the field line.
Did you leak out?
Now this is where there's absolutely no pitch angle scattering. So this is, in a sense, artificial.
And you must have injected this on parts 10 to the 19th, parts 10 to the 18th, parts 10 to the 17th or something?
Yeah. No, there's an equal number of particles sampled by a Monte Carlo distribution in each logarithmic energy bin. And then they're uniformly distributed in these different energy ranges and also distributed in angle. So there's a whole range of highest energy, medium energy. This is around 10 to the 18th, 10 to the 19th, 10 to the 16th, to 10 to the 17th. But we'll come back to this at the end. I just want to, I want to show you what the result is before we get into the physics.
Chuck, you talk about the GMB rates, I assume.
I will also bring back that issue, which is
some factor 100 difficulty with your number.
Okay. I have a slide buried at the end for that. And I was hoping to get something more definite from Jonathan's talk, but I'm not sure. Well, he certainly didn't give a number. So, this is the knee and beyond, and I assume everybody knows that beyond the knee is the ankle. If not, probably, if you think of beyond the knee is in a different direction, maybe this isn't the right talk for you. So Armin Atoyan is my principal collaborator. I've also worked with Jeremy Holmes and Stuart Wick. Okay, so here's the bottom line of the research that we've done, which is to try to develop a model, which is now a decade old at least, that the highest energy cosmic rays come from gamma ray bursts. The way we see it is there's a certain attraction of having gamma ray bursts as the progenitors of by high energy cosmic rays, I mean knee and above, because gamma ray bursts will occur in the galaxy as well as throughout the cosmos. So below about 10 to the 14th eV, most of the cosmic rays, we think, come from supernovae that collapse to form neutron stars, giving some sub-relativistic shock, accelerating up to some energies close to the knee, but probably not at the knee. Now, there's a whole range of supernova properties I'll mention, but once it seems that those supernovae that collapse to black holes are very different in the fact that they have relativistic outflows. So rather than pushing this first order Fermi acceleration barrier with non-relativistic shocks to try to get the high energy cosmic rays, there's many features in relativistic flows that make it easier to get the very high energies using relativistic shocks, the sort of relativistic blast waves that many people have. I mean, it's the standard model, the fireball blast wave model that dozens upon dozens of people have worked on by now. And in our picture, the transition, you have at the lowest energies, cosmic rays up to 100 keV per nucleon. But between the knee and the ankle, and the second knee, are primarily cosmic rays from gamma ray bursts in the galaxy. And from the second knee to the highest energies are cosmic rays produced throughout extragalactic space. Now, there's one point that's been brought up a number of times about, and I'm not going to say this is in any way solved, but this will ameliorate or at least mitigate the problems. The assumption is that as you reach the highest energy here, you have a power or an exponential decline. And you certainly would if you're talking about a source model and you're talking about acceleration to the highest energies permitted in the source. If you have competition with available time, size scale, or radiation losses, you get an exponential cutoff in your acceleration mechanism. But this cutoff is due to propagation, so it can be a much softer cutoff. In fact, it just steepens it effectively with power law. So that makes it rather easier to have a transition, a smooth transition between one component and another, that you wouldn't expect if you had this very steep cutoff from an exponential factor. So this is just one point I want to make sure people are aware about. Now, let's just talk about, this is an old picture as the knee was starting to be resolved. Here's a little bit newer picture, and what you see here, I mean, what I see anyway. Oh, I don't know if there's, how about a stick? That would work the best. But in any case, we see that the knee structure is becoming much more defined. In my opinion, it can actually be, as we work out the calibration difficulties, it could be quite a distinct feature. But at the present time, it's rather a blurry feature. The first knee, what we all know as the knee, is now coming in to much better focus than 5 years ago. It was a very confused state, and I attribute that to the Cascada data. And not being an observer myself, I sort of get my input, the validity of data by what the, how the observers approach talking about this. And it seems, and also from a sort of sense of feel, with this, you can see from this preliminary 2001 Cascada data, it has these features that are intuitively quite pleasing. Here's the proton knee, factor two more is the helium knee. Somewhat factor higher is the carbon, and consistent with a gyro radius dependence is the iron knee. And so this is the sequence where the break in total energy is proportional to the charge of the ion. That has been discussed for dozens of years, but at least the Cascada data has brought it into focus. And it's a blurred focus, I agree. It depends on how you deconvolve the air shower data, your particle physics model. But two people look at these and see two different things. Some people see lots and lots of differences. I see lots and lots of similarities. You still preserve this dependence of the knees for the different ionic species proportional to the charge. And
what's the difference in the model?
Now you're asking me about the particle physics aspects of the models and all
the stuff. Basically, the QGS camp produces the ionic interaction, produces more muons per interaction in the signal.
Is that what they know what the models are?
Not in the forward direction.
The people who use them know they are. Or they're just codes that
they know. You can't calibrate them in measurements, right? Which would be the best test.
Well, Thomas.
Well, the hydronic interaction, the hydronic interaction models are calibrated to data as far as is possible.
Right.
And the differences arise when you extrapolate beyond where things have been measured.
I was actually heard that each question.
You know these models that people use to describe, for example, LEP physics or
PCB, perturbative PCB.
Well, they have fragmentation and...
Yeah, they have.
So then they fit the parameters of the model. Usually it's a hybridization. It's
calibrated by testing against possible.
Right, and so those are what these model tests are. Those
so
are what
these are extrapolations.
These are basically the next generation of those models. But they're still very poorly constrained because the extrapolation of high energy is not clear.
So they're extrapolations of models that are used to generate events of collider time.
Right, right.
There's also the nuclear physics.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's done extremely naively. They just assume a kind of the most naive geometrical Glauber. The things simply break into two chunks, for instance.
Also, one of the problems is that in air shock physics, one's really interested in the stuff that goes down the beam pipe and whatever it's like. And that is a big unknown. Plus, you need to know about pi interactions on nuclei at energies weighted on machines. So there's a lot of uncertainty. And it may not be at all certain that those two models are actually students of what nature actually gives us. But we seem to fit the data broadly quite well. In particular, in this experiment, the STAB experiment, there has been a very careful study of the high-energy hadronic particles that are in the core of the extensive inner shell. And that's been used to try to test these models.
Okay, and as you see, there are considerable differences if you compare them on a point basis, but three things at least stick out to me is the fact that you have the Z dependence of the cutoffs for the different ionic species. You have rather consistent agreement between the all-particle spectrum, and you also have this interesting effect where the iron seems to be coming up. Even in both cases, it seems to be with a different spectral slope than the other species, as if it might originate from another source. But leaving that speculation behind, an interesting feature is, and maybe this is an artifact of the modeling, is how sharp the proton knee is. And even with the superposition of all these particle spectra, the all particle spectrum has a rather sharp knee. It's still within factors of three or four. You can quite well defined where that knee energy is. And the proton knee is really at 2 to 3 times 10 to the 15th, using very seems quite precise and.
Yeah, as I mentioned yesterday, jet experiment, which is carried out also by the NECA, showed more gradual change of the composition.
Well, if it's more gradual, it's easier to feel. The difficulty is if it's a very sharp feature to try to superpose emissions from many supernovae, it's difficult to get a very sharp feature. If it's smoother, then it's easier to fit. You can even add in some more components. But here, given the sharpness, the question is, can even with a single source model, can you get a fit this sharp? So let's just go back a step. So this is, of course, is an unsolved problem. The whole nature of the knee, this particles, cosmic rays from the knee all the way up. And we know from way back when that with naive first order Fermi acceleration, it's very difficult to accelerate much above the knee. Now here I've taken a scaling for oblique, for perpendicular shocks, not parallel shocks, which goes to the 2/3 power of the dimensionless shock speed. So if this is going out at speed c equals 1, you get 10 and 16 dB, but shock speeds are certainly a factor of 10 to 100 smaller than that.
But it's better not to do that versus also because they tend to 14. And there was a parallel shock acceleration model. So why? It's your formula, it's not Lagarce-Zarsky.
This is a generic feature of shock, but I think this paper certainly brought.
What we know from Lagarce-Zarsky goes to 10^14, and this is Stafford parallel shock acceleration.
Well, I've taken this beta not scaling. It goes down to 10^14 if you use 10^-2.
Because what we're talking is just like Jerkin type model. No.
I know, but all the same, it's very difficult to get far above the knee using naive shock acceleration theory. There are ways, there are parameters to twiddle, right? You can change the magnetic field in the surrounding environment, and Volk and Biermann tried to do that. Say that supernovae only go off in highly magnetized environments. But actually, you can get up to 10^17 dB, but by the time you get to higher energies, you need so much energy in your magnetized volume that it starts to dominate the energy content of the system. So it doesn't seem like you can get much above 10^17 dB. But And so you certainly do miss going to the highest energies. And you can go to faster initial speeds. So this begs the question, what are the speeds of supernova ejecta? Well, there's a whole variety of supernovae. The white dwarf detonation can reach 0.1 C. The core collapse where you have massive hydrogen envelopes rarely gets, you know, a few thousand kilometers per second. But once the shell, the envelope, is taken away, however, it is lost either through the stellar winds or through a binary companion. But this is observational. You see 1B and 1C supernova, you start seeing much more rapid shock speeds.
Chuck, can I ask a question about those? Those are shock speeds that break out from the supernova. Are you implying now that the cosmic rays are accelerated right down at the particularly
1Bs
and
1Cs,
the relatively compact star?
No, this is as the inner setoff phase. What's the beta knot? What's the value?
So this is velocity that refers to the end of the expansion.
That's right.
And that's late enough that you don't then still have to deal with adiabatic expansion losses?
There's all those issues that still have to be dealt with. Very naive. And adiabatic only takes you down to lower energies.
There's nothing with observation at this stage.
No. This is just plausibility arguments. That all the same, beta naught is a very important part of the puzzle.
Obviously, but, they have a higher velocity shock.
Yeah, so there's no big news there. But the thing is, if you're just appealing to first order Fermi acceleration to try to accelerate particles in these non-relativistic sources, hard to get to the knee. But of course, gamma ray bursts are like supernova with relativistic outflows, and that's opens up a number of different scenarios for particle acceleration. I consider the second order Fermi acceleration in the shock fluids, where you have alphane speeds that start to approach the speed of light. Eli himself prefers colliding magnetized shells, which also give you lots of feasibility to go to much higher energies. I forgot this, but Felix and Dereshev and his collaborators have talked about this converter mechanism for accelerating. So it opens up, these relativistic pathways open up new avenues for particle acceleration. Now, with respect to the previous talk, since Jonathan was here, I was hoping to get a harder number, but just using Frail's number, which doesn't have selection biases, considerations of jet structure, all sorts of factors in, they use a beaming factor of 1 over 500. I guess you have a paper where it's about a factor 5 or 10 lower.
Yeah. It's 10 lower because they used the observed
distribution,
which is biased. That's so true. It's a factor of 10 lower.
Okay, well.
I mean, this was just an error in their paper. That's it.
Okay, so. Given this number, we get something like 1 every 10,000 years. If it goes up to 1 every 100,000 years, it's in that range. We're comfortable with. But this doesn't take into account other possible sources, such as X-ray flashes or the short gamma ray bursts. But in any case, the fact, or at least the presumption, the implication that gamma ray bursts are highly beamed means that, well, two things. Their absolute energy isn't so great, but the number of sources, the source rate density, is that much proportionately larger. And you start to reach some small fraction of supernovae. So that makes sense. There's one supernova every 50 years in the galaxy, and one out of every 0.3% of those collapse to black holes. Seems quite reasonable. So maybe it's 10 kilojoules. For gamma ray bursts in the galaxy, maybe it's 100 kilojoules. If we had multiple sources in that Monte Carlo simulation that we were showing, you'd start seeing what's left behind of many gamma ray bursts as you start accumulating that. And what is the expected number of recent GRBs near Earth? It depends on energy. So actually, I mean, this was done with these numbers here, but if it was at a lower rate, 1 every 100,000 years, you'd have more energy, so it'd partly compensate for this factor. So this probability of being in a gamma ray burst, near a gamma ray burst, goes down dramatically depending on this rate. You have to put in these factors. But it's not unlikely that we would be sitting within the last million years within a kiloparsec of a gamma ray burst that went off. What happens when a gamma ray burst goes off? Well, now, Esteban talked about one mechanism for causing these breaks in the spectra. In our scheme, gamma ray bursts inject power law of particle spectra to the highest energies in our galaxy throughout. It's all the same. Of course, you can always change the Emax if you prefer, but most simply, all gamma ray burst sources are the same. They inject the power law spectrum from some low energy cutoff to the highest energies. And all the ionic species have essentially that same power law index. Those gamma ray bursts that occur in our galaxy, they propagate away. And there's essentially no radiative losses at below 10 to the 18 dB, so all the changes in the spectrum are due to propagation effects. And you have to steepen the source spectrum, and we're fairly familiar with how, I mean, just using spherically symmetric propagation models, you inject a power law. The faster particles leave more quickly than the slower particles. So once you're within this cosmic ray cloud, it's a steeper spectrum. And it depends on two things, at least. The spectrum of turbulence. Okay, so 5/3 Kolmogorov, 3/2 Kreitman. And it also depends whether it's an impulsive or a continuous source. So if we're talking about a 5/3 spectrum, so that'd be 1/3. So this is for an impulsive source, you get a steepening of 1/2. And this is, this steepens. Well, let's go to a Kreitman spectrum, 3/2. Then you'd steepen it by 1/2 for a continuous source, and you'd steepen it by, 9/4.
Can I ask a question?
3/4, 0.75 for an impulsive source. Okay.
I guess it's a technical question, but it's one.
Let me just finish this off, though. The point being that depending whether it's an impulsive or a continuous source, you're steepening the source spectrum, and then it's just a question of what sort of turbulent spectrum do we need in order to match the data, and then let's try to understand the turbulent spectrum.
Just out of curiosity, Elliot asked this question yesterday's talk of how come nobody in the business is trying to make use of the Goldilocks-Schrödinger turbulence? mean, Ben Chandra wrote a paper a couple of years ago using that, just looking at the for standard cosmic ray transport. It makes a big difference.
Yes.
This is what comes out.
The diffusion is much faster than what you might think.
There are many, if you take seriously the Goldilocks Feeder model, that's a lot of this stuff is in deep trouble.
Right. Well, and Ellie mentioned that yesterday, but I had to point out that in the Earth Star Shop, they do measure Kolmogorov spectrum turbulence.
I'm aware of that. We're talking about interstellar turbulence.
And when they use
and to, if you're going to start
correlation
quoting data,
pulsars, you also see.
If you're going to start quoting data at me, the observations of pulsar simulation indicate rather strongly that the interstellar turbulence has the kind of anisotropy that you expect from Goldilocks Feeder.
And can you characterize that by a turbulence index?
You calculate it with two turbulence indices.
It's because it's anisotropic.
It becomes two-dimensional, it's more scale.
So yeah, the anisotropy, because of the strong stringy structures in one dimension, it changes the particle transport a whole lot.
Oh,
I'm just wondering.
More complications make it, in principle, even easier to fit there.
I consider an irresponsible answer.
Granted, all these questions that are valid and need to be researched, still naively asking what's the turbulence spectrum that will enable us to fit this data. But just pointing out, for an impulsive source with a power law turbulence spectrum, you get this, so the injection, and then you're sitting someplace from it, so the particles diffuse towards you. The highest energy particles hit you first, you're in this cosmic ray bubble. And then the lower energy particles, you feel it at a later time, and then the higher energy particles flow away. So you're in, at lower energies, you're in the bubble later, but for a much longer time than at the highest energies. And this, I think Felix actually is on a nice paper that does the analysis leading to this equation along with Arman and Flair. But here's the turbulence spectrum that we found actually gives nice fits to the data, and the question is, does it make any sense? Well, it turns out that we have the injection of turbulence at about 10 inverse parsecs. One inverse parsec. So this is sort of one parsec injection of the turbulence, and then you have a steep spectrum turbulence. So this is minus 5/3. So it's Kolmogorov here. And here you have another injection of turbulence at about 100 parsec scale, and it's a flatter injection spectrum of turbulence. And that would correspond to a Kraken spectrum of turbulence. And why is that? Well, we don't know. We just tried to find something that, given those relations, which imply the spectral indices, this actually makes the data very fittable. But we had to smooth it, otherwise it just introduces these very hard boundaries, because we do a very simple transport. I mean, this sort of prescription is easily 20 years old, where the mean free path is inversely proportional to the energy density of the turbulence at the resonant wave number. So if that's clear to you, then I don't have to go into further explanation. This is the very simplest way to make that prescription for gyro-resonant turbulence acceleration.
Chuck, I know this is not your main point, but if you go to this large case, I think this will not be consistent with the measured lifetimes of cosmic rays.
So
you
a
have
great
another
point.
Change at higher energies.
These very large wave case. Vectors, which gyro resonate with the lowest energy cosmic rays, it actually recovers what we know from the 1 to 100 GeV per nucleon physics. If you let this spectral index continue here, because then the Kreifmann form takes over and you get a 0.5 for the supernovae or continuous sources, then you get an 0.5 steepening, so you steepen nicely from a 2.2 injection to an 0.5. So we have ways to, it does reproduce what we think is the mean free path for scattering at 10 to 1,000 GeV per nucleon range, and this appropriate spectral index. But here, let's focus on the Mi right now.
When sparsely rectilinear propagation, when diffusion will be finished?
Well, there's really no specific energy.
There will be no edge dependence, simply
Right here is essentially where you start to get the transition to quasi-rectilinear propagation, but there's still, when turbulence cascades, you get a low wave number contribution to the turbulence that can still affect the propagation. But this effectively corresponds to energies of about the second mean.
Yeah. Actually, that is interesting check, because then you repeat source spectrum of that.
Exactly. That's a good point. I hope we come back to that. But before we get there, let me just finish this thought. So why would 1 parsec and 100 parsecs be a favored energy link scale for injecting turbulence? 1 parsec is characteristic of a set-off scale. You have supernova going off everywhere, dumping in turbulence on sort of set-off link scale, which is a parsec. This is a link scale corresponding to the galactic disk. We just speculate. You have high-velocity clouds pounding through the disk. There's all sorts of halo-disk interactions that somehow the disk scale size injects turbulence.
So much?
Oh, it's still the integrated energy density of all this turbulence is still 10% of the large-scale field energy density, so it's in the quasi-linear regime.
It's a very big amount for clouds, halo clouds hitting the disk.
Well, it's not... Well, I don't know who told you that. It seems reasonable to me.
Out of curiosity, do you think high-velocity clouds are local?
Well, local to our galaxy?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Why?
Because you see some going away, some coming toward us. And
I wasn't familiar with much in the way going away, but there are plenty of people who think that they're quite
extra galactic. Yeah. Okay, well, there's a number of mechanisms to inject turbulence on
those
scales.
At the flat assertions.
Okay, so here's your Lorimer radius. So these things are bound. But as they go, some multiple, sometimes factor of hundreds to a thousands greater than the Lorimer radius, then they're completely deflected. So the mean free path is much longer, of course, than the Lorimer radius, because we're in a quasi-linear regime. And this just shows mean free path of protons and iron, as well as Lorimer radius. And Ellie's correct. We have to be careful that when we get down to GeV per nucleon, that we have a mean free path and diffusion coefficient that corresponds to what we know from secondary to primary ratios. So this is another calculation, but now with this more detailed turbulence spectrum. So you have a gamma ray burst at 2,000 years. We're sitting 500 parsecs away. There's total energy and cosmic rays that come out. It's a power law between 10 to the 14th eV and 10 to the 20th eV. Bang, even by 2,000 years, the highest energy particles have passed the psi. And then the cosmic ray cloud surrounds us, and we see this cutoff having to do with propagation. So these particles just propagate, and there's a break having to do with a break in the turbulence spectrum.
So this was put, this calculation that Jeremy was put in, a half a kiloparsec away.
Mm-hmm.
So when you say the count due to propagation, does that mean it's just that the high energy particles have gone away?
By this time, the high energy particles, whoops.
But that's what you mean by so if I look at...
Yeah, you can see that the lower energy particles stay around for a much longer time. So here's the knee right here. And you would see if we had been... Well, it's a little complicated, the diagram, but... Okay, so this is what we're using to fit it.
Equal even are on the same wavelength of making spaghetti diagrams.
We have a less complicated version of the figure in our even the referee didn't like this, but somehow I didn't think that.
The referee, unfortunately, you didn't have a referee before you put that out here.
I just couldn't find the figure. But anyway, you can see that this is the sort of age at which you do the fit. Here's the second knee structure, and here's the iron then.
So I'm actually a little confused. You like your 2,000 year thing, you have a spectrum which has got lots of high energy particles and almost no low energy particles.
Okay.
Is that the right way of interpreting that?
That's right. The low energy particles haven't diffused to it yet.
They haven't arrived yet.
So, no, so the low energy particles haven't arrived yet.
Okay.
So you have, so this is a, that's right, the diffusion coefficients of larger and higher energy, gotcha.
Mm-hmm. And you presumably...
So you're watching the diffusion wave in both, real space and energy space.
You could look at it that way, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Presumably you could make a map of the anisotropy of the function of time. It would be useful.
We'll get, the anisotropy question is very important, and I, what you say, I haven't done that, but we do consider what the expected anisotropy is.
Well, your formula is for isotropic diffusion.
No, I'll come back to that point.
Your formula is for isotropic diffusion, I understand.
Yes. Isotropic.
By definition, you could not calculate within this formula is the...
No. It's isotropic diffusion, but as it passes to you, the characteristic scale of anisotropy is the mean free path divided by the sort of distance from the source.
The scattering is isotropic, but the particle distribution is not.
Yeah, I mean, it's an impulsive source.
There's a diffusive flux that's passing over.
Yeah, it's sensitive.
So there's more coming from that direction, the source direction, than the other direction.
Inside the cloud of propagating the cloud.
Yeah, the longer your wave, the more isotropic it becomes.
Yes, that's in correct. That sense, yeah. This is, but you have the isotropic. So the cloud expands and you appear inside the cloud.
That's right.
One question.
Pitch angle diffusion?
This is resonant, but this is resonant pitch angle diffusion.
What's the, you have kiloplastic a wave or a 10 to the 19
meter particle? Instead of the 19 PV. So by the time 2,000 years, even the 10 to the 19 PV particles have effectively, so here's the proton, and here's the ion. They've passed by. I mean, they just...
How do you choose the ratio of the two?
To fit the data.
That's always a good idea.
Okay, so you want to see our data fit. I mean, I know you observers go to lots and lots of trouble to get data, so I hope we don't misuse it, but there's a fit to the data. That doesn't prove the model is right, but it does pass this minimum test that if you can't fit the data, no matter how many assumptions you make, that's the minimum bar you have to jump over, I think.
Chuck, isn't it true that if you have sufficiently large enough number of free parameters in the model, you can always see the data?
No, because that assumes all the data is correct. And you know that's not the case.
As usual, everyone.
Fermi is reputed to have said with three parameters, Fermi, he could fit an elephant. Then again, there are many cases with 20 parameters, you still fail fit. So.
Anyway. Accepting all these caveats.
There are some problems with protons.
I know, that's interesting. That with our, we do miss this by two, maybe 2.5 sigma, this last point. And it's even a little bit here. Maybe it has to do with that there's different injection indices.
Here we've assumed. Which is kind of.
This is the 2001 preliminary data. So it's changed since then, I agreed. But I think in the general outline, it's still. Essentially, I mean, we're going to modify the compositions a little bit. The most difficult thing is for the iron to fit that with the same spectral index, but especially with the new data. But here, it misses a bit.
The black dotted and the blue dotted, did you say in
Einstein? You're talking for this one?
Yeah.
Okay, this is a wave, if that's what you mean. This is the uncertainty band that Cascada provided, and this is the model fit. Is that what you mean? And this is their actual data. But they said there's additional systematics. This is, again, from 2001.
So Chuck, the main thing that bothers me here is that this is a fairly unlikely rate of events. So without beaming, the rate of GRBs in a galaxy like ours would be roughly 1 per 100 million years. And with the
it's more than that.
This is... It's fairly secure.
It depends on the relative evolution.
Yeah.
How many cubic megaparsecs per L-star galaxy do you use?
0.03
galaxy per cubic megaparsec. 0.03. No, it's 0.003. Like 300 megaparsecs, cubic megaparsecs per L-star.
What? No. You have your numbers wrong with factor of 10. So maybe this is part of the difference.
so...
No, I don't think that's correct.
Sloan is always 0.02 or 0.03.
For L-star galaxy, L-star spiral galaxy.
For L-star, yeah. So it's 0.03, not 0.003, so this is a factor of 10. So then you get one per 100
years. There's lots of Scholar and Wheeler and Byers and Company, Naturalium, they're all wrong then.
No. The rate of GRBs is 0.5 per cubic megaparsec per year, and the number of L-star galaxy per cubic megaparsec is 0.03. So you get exactly one per 100 million years. And then, if you take a beaming factor 100, you get one, even, which is a bit an exaggeration, but let's say, you get one per million years in the galaxy. Now, most of the stars in 500 parsecs around the sun is a very small fraction. So the probability, this will be, I don't know, once every 100 million years, roughly. So there's a factor of like 10,000.
No, I don't agree with the numbers.
So starting with the density of L-star galaxies.
I mean, it always surprised me that the density of L-star galaxies is so small, too. But this is the average density in the local universe.
What, 0.003?
No, so one every 200 cubic megaparsecs.
No, come on, no, this is 0.03 per cubic megaparsec, you know that.
The cube root of, 200 or 300 is 5.
So I think there's no point arguing the numbers, but you should read the paper.
I read them, and that's the number I obtained. Okay, so we fit the data.
Check about this mass composition of source. This iron, carbon.
Okay.
You talk about GRB, so what do you expect in this case? Like you said, all very much?
Indeed, you need changes in composition when going from, if you consider what the ratios of the ionic species are, at say 10 GeV per nucleon, by the time you get up here, you need enhanced carbon and iron. So the compositions are enhanced in order to fit the data by some factors of 3 to 5.
So in these figures, you assumed some composition.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Relevant to GRBs.
Relevant to fitting the data.
Which are different than supernova remnants would give you, or?
Well, I don't know about supernova remnants if you compare with solar metallicity. Hydrogen diversity. It's a carbon is something, I don't remember the exact numbers, 3 to 5 for carbon or order 5. But 3 to 10 for iron.
Solar bodies issue.
It's enriched by some factors of 3 to 10 for carbon and iron. And helium was also enriched. After all, the helium is above the hydrogen, even if you extrapolate that to local
issues. So what material are you accelerating?
The underlying assumption of this model is that we're injecting power law cosmic ray ions with the same index of the highest energies. So if there is no acceleration model that can do that, then I admit we have some difficulties.
But are you accelerating the material that is blown off by the precursor wind, or are you accelerating the whole galaxy, or what?
Didn't you answer that question to me saying that you fit the data and then you go back? I mean, is it from first principles?
This is still an interesting question to ask. In terms of a colliding shell scenario, then you'd be driving the material that you accelerate from the outflowing plasma, whatever is ejected from the gamma ray burst. I don't know if nuclei can survive the gamma ray burst fireball, given the incredible. But I favor an external shock where you have additional acceleration from second order processes within the blast wave.
Is that where the neutrons came from too?
You can get neutrons that way as well. But that's a little bit different of a... Photohadronic processes. In fact, if I have time, I'll return to that point too. So we already had that. And it's an interesting that if you look at the latest release of the Cascada data, that they have an iron with a low energy cutoff. I mean, it's lower than we were using, which is sort of like 100 GeV. It's more like 1 GeV. But, well, this is kind of astonishing. I think if you assume that all the iron was from supernova remnant acceleration, because why would you have this low energy cutoff? Maybe there is a good explanation that Tom, but But it...
That's not a measurement from Pascal, that's a GEA.
Oh, sorry, of course not, of course not. I just grabbed it off of Ferrandl, so...
Yeah, no, that's it. That's due to the propagation, because it's a lot of energy, so the collisions are still competing with propagation for iron. So you're seeing the source spectrum rather than that's the dimensional information of that.
Okay, well...
Sorry, I don't quite understand. That cutoff, that low energy cutoff is due to collisional losses? Is that what you said?
This is not due to the solar wind. So what we see in the protons at QGV is what we see in the iron at 100 GeV.
So these are observations or what?
Yes.
This is part of low energy data.
Yeah, that's 100 GeV.
Well, it has nothing to do with Pascal, except that...
But if these are observations, so you have very flat iron spectrum. So you multiply to 2.5.
So it's that low energy cutoff that's present. That's
okay.
It's not a cutoff.
So, sorry. It's not part of the GeV per nucleon.
It's
so
to the minus 2 or something.
My mistake.
Yeah, it should be either, you should, at low energy, you should be the source spectrum.
Okay, moving on. This point about anisotropy that was mentioned. Of course, this is just related to the ratio of the mean free path for scattering at that energy to the sort of characteristic distance upon which the flux changes its intensity. And for the single source diffusion model, you actually get an energy independent anisotropy in this very naive model where you have three-dimensional isotropic turbulence, spherically symmetric scattering. But it's on this order of 0.5%. And I mean, you sort of need 0.1 to 0.4% at the knee region. We've seen this earlier today, or earlier this conference. And these numbers are, you know, a little tight, but we consider only a single gamma ray burst. There's going to be some residual emission from other gamma ray bursts that will reduce the anisotropy. But this is touch and go about the anisotropy. You can get under it, but then it comes back to this issue about the rate of gamma ray bursts per ejection
time. How does the anisotropy reduce as the number of sources? Is it root n?
It's sort of a square root. The fewer number of sources, it goes as a square root of n because your energy is greater, but the probability that you'd be at a certain distance from the source is less. But indeed, it increases the anisotropy in general. Okay. Well, that was basically the knee part. So let me just summarize, you know, the whole picture then. So we know this, these energy losses very well. And what's important to point out here is that this trough is around 10 to the 19 dB for redshift and unity, zero. By the time you get to redshift and unity, this photopair trough is 5 times 10 to the 18. And so when we continue up beyond the knee region and try to fit data throughout intergalactic space with cosmic rays coming in, those protons are subject to photopion, photopair and expansion losses, but it depends upon the star formation rate, or in this case, the cosmic ray formation rate density of the universe. And this is sort of a Madow type curve here, but it might be a factor of 10 higher if extinction corrections are important. And indeed, this trough is greatly enhanced if there is much more activity in ultra-high energy cosmic rays at large redshifts. And we were driven to the conclusion that the transition between the galactic and extragalactic component couldn't be, or probably is not, at the angle, because this is so nicely explained as a photopair trough, as also Berzinski has pointed out. And it's much more likely that this transition is at the second knee.
Okay. I might not know this, but if you put in the same mix, maybe they should put it the lower energies. That goes away.
What goes away?
If you mix other nuclei. Because now you have to put protons on to explain the A plus C minus as an angle. But
It's hard to hear you. Can you speak down?
What I'm saying is that he argued that the gamma ray burst in the galaxy could be this sort of the lower energy in the area, and then this would be the high energy area, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you try to use the same composition you put at the knee for the extragalactic component, that E plus C minus dip goes away.
Actually, we're using only protons at the highest energy.
But if you want to make it equal, then
there's a number of reasons. If you accelerate iron or any charged species, there's some difficulty getting them out. They're subject to photodisintegration at the highest energy.
Protons with a different spectrum if you started with a mixed spectrum. You measure protons.
That's an interesting point.
Yeah, we just did this.
But
you wouldn't have known, but unless you did.
Anyway, it's minus 2.2 all the way that we inject for protons. And our Graninger point, since we're only considering protons here, I guess I don't have to worry about that undermining anything I show at this point. But okay, it's better fit for the upper star formation rate. Inject a minus 2 spectrum. And so this is the minus 2.2 would go up here without losses, but you have these very powerful radiative losses on the protons. There's a second knee. But to fit those, it implies a local luminosity density of the cosmic rays in gamma ray bursts of something like 50 to 200 times 10 to the 44 ergs per cubic megaparsec per year. Now this generic value of 10 to the 44 ergs per cubic megaparsec per year corresponds to the electromagnetic fluence. It's inferred from the electromagnetic fluence at MeV energies from gamma ray bursts. So these have to be highly baryonic dominated to make this model work. So every gamma ray burst, it might put out what ends up resulting in a 10 to the 44 ergs per cubic megaparsec per year local luminosity density, but the gamma ray bursts itself are highly baryonically dominated.
Chuck, we know that this is not the case.
And tell me that. Why is that?
Because we know from afterglow observations, we have good measurements of the energy.
Yeah, but these particles escape in the prompt phase.
These are protons. From afterglow, you could not know about protons.
We know the total energy of the explosion from the afterglow.
No, it's the energy of protons, they are missing energy. You could measure proton energy.
No. You measure the total explosion energy.
But how do you know which part goes to the protons?
I don't care how much it goes, because I know the dynamics of the shock wave.
No, I agree with you.
And
you're right.
The GMP protons do not escape anywhere.
You're quite right, in the afterglow phase, correct. But
so
there's lots of escape during the prompt.
You argue that in the prompt phase, you produce all the energy is disappearing.
There's a large loss of energy during the prompt phase.
So then the energy of these explosions, which are associated with supernovae, would be 10 to the 53 ergs with the explosion?
10 to the 52 ergs.
No. They are now, the measured energy is 10 to the 51.
Right, so then you have an epsilon E parameter of 1.1, so that means there's already a large fraction of that in protons already.
So this gives you...
Up to 10 to the 52, you have a baryonic loading of a factor 50.
You're not worried about this energy for a supernova explosion?
You mean being larger than a characteristic supernova?
Being about 50 times larger than a supernova.
I think gamma ray bursts are quite a bit different than just a normal supernova. If you're talking about the standard energy reservoir result, which isn't understood even given a baryon loading, so you say this might make it more difficult to understand how you could have a standard energy reservoir.
But it's not just the total energy.
So the total energy is 10 to the 52 ergs instead of 1.5 times 10 to the 51.
I have another problem with this plot. Mm-hmm. You said you fit 2.2, right? Everybody else gets 2.6, and I was trying to find out why. And you put Emax 10 to the 20, is that what
it is? Emax is 10 to the 20.
Then this is not a GZK cutoff, it's just Emax. Then you can fit anything you want, right?
Well, actually, no. I mean, it's a minus 2.2, it comes up here, and by the time it sails down, it's way over here. It's quite modified. Even with an Emax of 10 to the 20.
Oh, just you got a little bit of a pile up, but then
no,
you're
not
sort
sure.
of.
Sure, it's not true, because if you have a 2.2, it's very hard. So even you go 3 times 10 to 20, exponent is not so dramatic.
Well, 10 people have tried to fit this high energy part with, you know, you know, everybody gets 2.6, right? Even if it's wrong, I'm just saying it's the best fit. We've done this, other groups have done it. But that's usually because, you know, we assume that the feature at the end is the GZK cutoff, so we put Emax to be above 3 times 10 to the 20. But if you put Emax at 10 to the 20, then you have a combination of GZK plus Emax right there.
And who's to say that's not the case? I mean, when you do acceleration scenarios, believe me, at least with GRBs, it's hard to, you can't get the 10 to the 21.
I'm just saying,
you can get the 3 times 10 to the 20th if you twist double knob.
You're not going to get 2.2.
So 10 to the 20th is quite a reasonable cutoff energy, and if it violates
If we measure
the purity of a GZK cutoff, so be it.
Another problem.
But do you agree that 2.6 is not very reasonable?
I agree, but what I'm saying, I was surprised, why did he get 2.2?
I'm surprised, I didn't know this number, 2.6.
So if you take Brzezinski's fix to the A plus C minus, it's 2.6. If you take ours, our fit.
This 2.6 is not due to the 10 to the 20. The 2.6 actually is due to the fact you're trying to explain down to 10 to the 18. And if you want to get the slope between 10 to the 18 and 10 to the 19, this is where the 2.6 comes in, becomes important. This is where you get the 2.6. It has nothing to do with the GZK.
No, what I'm saying is the following. If you take 2.2 and you let Emacs be large, you're going to have a hard time fitting, well, depends on the data, obviously. The data is all over the map. But if you try to make a, what I would call, reasonable fit, that's not going to happen.
I disagree there. I think 2.2 fits perfectly well the data left into the 19. You get higher spectral index only if you want to fit the lower energy data. If you want to fit everything also down to 10 to the 18, then you need the spectral index.
Well, anyway.
I just want to make a more confusing remark, which is that Hill's fit is at 2.3.
Yeah, so this is
half the high energy.
He does a full evolution propagation, and it's 2.3.
I think you can easily fit it with anything between 2 and 2.3.
It seems to me that the one conclusion I'm drawing is, I'm sure I'm wrong about it, but let me put it out and see if it applies. I would say that this energy number here is correct. You're going to get some kind of number like that from the power requirement if you try to fit the explain the angle is due to electron energy losses.
That's right.
And if you want to have and that's why in your model, I mean, to make yours all consistent, you don't want to explain the angle that way. You want to have it lower.
That's right. Although this is a bit high, this is surprisingly high, even taking into account what you.
But what power, when you do your fit, Angela, what power requirement?
No, I'm just saying, take the data, you don't have a model. Just make a propagation of an injection spectrum with a gamma factor and make the best
you
can.
Normalize it to the data.
You normalize it, let's say, to the 19.
He asks, how much energy, what is the energy injection rate that you get? I don't know.
So
I think it should
number.
I think it would be roughly 10 to the 45, down to 10 to the 18.
Yeah,
so this is a bit high.
Because we're going down to 10 to the 14.
Because you even go
for. If we went all the way down to 1 GeV per nuclear, which would violate the data,
okay,
it'd be another factor of 10.
So I think if you go down to 10 to the 18, it would be about 10 to the 45. But this is like taking it even farther down.
And what sets him in?
Nothing sets him. It's a low energy cutoff, so if you have relativistic shock and you bleed if it's external shock, then you have a gamma squared bounce to the first acceleration phase, so it might be 300 squared GeV is the low energy cutoff. That's 100 GeV, and that's essentially what we take.
And there's another Emax. I'm trying to read what that is.
Emax is for the halo, 10 to the 17th. So, of course, we had also to find out what.
I'm not following this. This is another, what's the halo Emax? Sorry.
Well, actually it's just a power law it's not clear what the spectrum of turbulence is that determines the escape at the highest energies in the galaxy. So instead of tuning the turbulence spectrum below this injection size scale of 1/100th of a parsec, 1 over 100 parsecs, we just use an Emax for the maximum energies of cosmic rays in the galaxy. This is work that Armin's doing, so But as you see, this is quite steep, and depending on where the truth will lie from Auger, there's room to argue that this doesn't fit. You know, who knows what the result will be. But this assumes a homogeneous injection at all redshifts. But of course, we live within a local supercluster. Within our supercluster, there's structure and there's enhanced injection. And there's a possibility that you're going to get some super GZK events from gamma ray bursts taking place within the local supercluster. And that's work in progress. Alan talked about this a lot, and I just will say, as a prediction of our law, compositional change, of course, takes place around the vicinity of the second knee, where you start going from heavy back to light composition. That's got to suggest that. But I know Havre Park data doesn't, so that's an open question.
There's more than
that's correct. And so let me just say it as a prediction of the model, that the compositional change takes place around the second knee. There's no compositional change around the photopair trough. And this is our model prediction compared to the Cascada, early Cascada data.
Since Peter is away, I'll take his place and say that you have to wrap up.
Oh, okay. Fine.
Despite very the fact good. That John is...
Okay, well, this was neutrino week, and we've, because these are baryon dominated, neutrinos will be made, and we can talk about this more tomorrow, but we predict neutrinos. This issue about the cosmic ray escape, that's already been touched. Well, you're accelerating protons. They undergo photopair processes to make the neutrinos, and the neutrons flow out to become. And they can become some component of the ultra-high energy cosmic rays. So this whole acceleration question is still a bit open about if ions are accelerated to the highest energies, or is it just neutrons? Neutrons that escape. So I think you've gotten the picture of what we're doing. A large baryon load. We can't do the Agassiz data with conventional astrophysical models. We just need extraordinarily hard injection spectra. It still barely fits the Agassiz data with the reduced chi-squared, and we don't fit. There's still mysteries galore. So if Agassiz is right, of course, this is all wrong. Contrary-wise, we predict that the results will be more consistent with the high res and an effective GZK cutoff. We calculate cascade fluxes that should be seen as separate emission components in gamma ray bursts related to the total photomason cascade. These are Armin's nice calculations. Going back to the beginning of my talk, this is our magnetic field geometry for the large scale field we use. There's the question about the rate of these events in the galaxy. And what happens when a gamma ray burst is pointed toward it is Earth. I want to make as a final point, there's a paper that appeared last year by Medina Franco Bierman et al, that the sugar point source, this low significance excess 10 to the 18th cosmic ray point source, consistent with a sub-degree source, they proposed that this was a gamma ray burst in the galaxy. The neutrons were coming out and hitting us. But we have a paper in the refereeing stage where we argue this is not exactly correct. These neutrons from our simulations just pass through the Earth, just along with these photon clouds, especially if they're 10 to the 18th eV. So the only time available for us to detect something like a gamma ray burst impulsive event was within the weeks or so of the event itself, probably within the days, and the gamma ray burst jet has to be pointed toward us. So if the sugar event is correct, we're reversing their interpretation. It can't be from a gamma ray burst. It has to be a persistent source, like a microquasar. So we predict no sugar point source if this cosmic ray model is correct. Or at least the cosmic ray model is grossly incomplete. But we're betting that the sugar point source is not correct.
To fight for sugar points, sugar data.
He's fighting against it. He already won.
Well, Alan hasn't told us, but this is, I mean, we're trying to get this in press before the answer comes out. Of course, if the answer is against us, maybe we're hoping for to be rejected. So, It's all, in a sense, it's a single source model. In a sense, it's all the traditional supernova we've grown to love. Ginsburg and Cernovsky, just some modifications to the supernovae that collapse to black holes and release relativistic outflows. And so we argue that the knee is parallel injection modified by propagation, which is contrary to what Ehrlich and Wolfendale have argued. Even though they have single source models, they say that it can't be propagation characteristics, but more likely due to the variation of the source properties. Our GRB model requires that they're hadronically dominated, which is good for neutrino detection, but we claim that our model is inconsistent with their sugar source. So.